Timothy Bartley versus Commonwealth. Mr. Hallahan, you have 15 minutes to present your argument. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
All right. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the phone accommodation. Timothy Bartley's case, I was appointed on it by the Circuit Court after the suppression motion and trial. I only handled the appeal. Why I think this case is important and why I think the Circuit Court judge should have suppressed the should have sustained the motion to suppress is that this is a case, everyone agrees the search warrant was valid. It was an all persons, all vehicles therein search warrant on the property. But why this case is different and why my client's vehicle should not have been searched is my client was not present, his vehicle was not present when the search warrant was executed, nor did he arrive on his own during the search warrant. Now, if he had just rolled up during the execution of the search warrant. Yes, sir.
This is Judge Petty. Let me ask you a very, very preliminary question here, because I think your argument on this issue may have some merit, but are you familiar with Rule 5820 of our Rules of Court?
Without looking at, I don't know the rule by number, Your Honor.
The rule requires that the opening brief contain the principles of law, the argument, and the authorities relating to each question presented. And we have held that unsupported assertions of error do not merit appellate consideration. Now, your brief has absolutely no legal argument or any supporting citations for your position. So for us to rule in your favor, we would effectively have to become advocates for your case. Now, my question is this. Did you choose not to include any citations, or are there none? Is there no legal support for your argument?
Well, I guess I apologize. There is basically the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution requires a warrant to search anything.
And they had a warrant.
Well, that is for all persons present therein in vehicles. But in this particular case, the police lured somebody onto the property.
But is
that would have been no different.
Are there any cases that say the police can't do that? That's what I'm interested in knowing. Any court in the country held that it is police misconduct to search someone who arrives on the premises at their request if they have a search warrant to do so?
I don't know, Your Honor. And
how do we reverse a trial court unless there's some authority for us to do so?
The authority would be to he was not the search warrant. There's case law on search warrants to say you can't go outside the scope of the search warrant. And there's nothing in the search warrant.
Any of those cases in your brief?
I cited the Carroll case, which I was debunking. The Commonwealth was trying to justify the search with the Carroll case, and I debunked the Carroll case in my brief. I thought I did that. I didn't.
Well, let's switch gears, counsel. Mr. Jones, in his brief, cites several cases, including Arizona versus Lewis, which is obviously an Arizona case, and Logan versus Georgia, which is a Georgia case, that deal with the issues that are raised in the context of this case. And there is no response by you with regard to his suggestion that we apply the principles in the Arizona and the Georgia case. What would be your response orally to the citation of those cases by the government?
Your Honor, I was focused on the fact on the Carroll case, they are trying to use the warrantless, a vehicle is more mobile, and a vehicle can be searched without a warrant. There's no extra circumstances here. If the police had put a sale that said yard sale with an arrow into the yard, and people pulled into the yard sale, there's no difference than what the police did in this case. They told the guy to call the supplier and have him drive up.
Let me stop you there and ask you this question. In your brief, you concede that the search warrant is valid.
Yes, sir.
And you concede that the search warrant covers people arriving at the residence during its execution.
Yes, sir.
The only argument is somehow that there's a different standard because the police lured your client to the premises. However,
yes, sir.
In the opinion letter by the trial court, footnote 1, he makes a factual finding that the police did not do that, that the defendant arrived at the behest of the owner of the premises. How does that affect the argument?
I don't think anybody would find that the owner of the premises was the target of the search warrant was not an agent of the Commonwealth. He never would have called him over there at that time if the police weren't there to do it.
But again, counsel, in the context of your arguments, you've never suggested that there was an entrapment, which is a totally different analysis.
Oh, we wouldn't say there's entrapment because my guy had scales in the car with residue on it. You'd have to show that he was not prone to that type of criminal behavior. I believe entrapment, for it to be entrapment. I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that the police, a search warrant, the scope of the search warrant is all persons present or vehicles present. He was not any of those. The search warrant doesn't say and anyone else the police or people can lure onto the property. This is a total stretch. This is totally outside the scope of the search warrant, and that was the issue I had with the case.
But that goes back to Judge Petty's question. Given that the fact finder explicitly rejects that the police lured him onto the property, if that's your argument, doesn't it suffer from a fatal flaw? Because we can't, I mean, there was testimony that this was a totally voluntary act by the person whom the search warrant was initially served. I mean, how do we get around that factual finding given that there was testimony to that effect?
Okay. Number one is I disagree with that finding that it was not the police were involved because he wouldn't have done it if the police weren't there.
Do you understand the import of a factual finding by the trial court? Whether you agree with it or not, whether we agree with it or not, is irrelevant. As long as there's evidence to support it, we have to accept that factual finding.
I understand. Right, most favorable. This is the way you get around it. Assuming that the police had nothing to do with it, assuming the police had nothing to do with that phone call to lure my client onto the property, then you've got to the point on probable cause to search the vehicle. What do you have? You have an unreliable informant. If someone walked up on the street and said, hey, that guy sells meth, you need to search his car, the police can't do that. They've got to have a reliable informant or some sort of separate probable cause. In this particular case, you just have a guy say, hey, I get meth from this guy, and calls him, and the guy shows up. And the fact that the guy had no meth on him at all, he had residue on scales, he had no meth to sell, he was supposed to be bringing meth over to sell, and he shows up with nothing, that goes to show the guy's unreliable.
We don't view probable cause after the search occurred, do we? We review the presence of probable cause prior to the search.
Yes, sir, and I would submit that there was lacking probable cause because they had an unreliable informant.
Why do you say, I mean, what is the case law that would tell us that this is an unreliable informant?
There's been nothing done on law enforcement angle to prove him reliable. He hasn't done any buys, and he hasn't done any controlled buys. He hasn't given them information previously that panned out to be legitimate. There's several things they can do to make someone a reliable informant, and in this case, there was nothing done at all. He was the target of the search warrant. They rolled up on him and with no basis, with no history with this guy, with there's nothing to make him reliable.
But
he just says, oh, I'm going to call this guy, and they search his car immediately upon arrival onto the property.
Counsel, but they know that the informant is in the meth trade, and they know because they've witnessed him call up and order more meth. Isn't that different fundamentally than just randomly saying, hey, that guy over there sells meth?
I would submit that it's not. He could have called anybody. He could have called somebody that. See, that's the thing we don't know about this guy. Maybe he did call his legitimate meth dealer, but maybe he called someone he didn't like to get him over there so they could get busted. Maybe that's all it was. We don't know if this guy was a meth dealer or not. You're taking the word of an unreliable informant, so we don't know what his intentions were when he picked my client to call him.
Well, but isn't the recitation of the conversation essentially that he ordered more meth?
Yes, sir.
If you call me and order more meth, I can't come over and give you more meth because I don't have any.
I understand, Your Honor. I understand.
You're into your rebuttal. You may continue if you wish, or reserve the remainder.
I reserve the remainder.
Thank you. Mr. Jones?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones for the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm the circuit court. The search was acceptable.
Well, before you get to the search, Mr. Jones, let me ask you this, and I appreciate your citation of authority to help us work our way through this. But in this case, do you believe that the appeal fails for on a substantive basis, i.e. the probable cause and the issues that Mr. Hallahan is raising now, or do you believe the case is procedurally defaulted?
I believe that the case is procedurally defaulted under Rule 5A20, and also I don't believe we raised this on brief, but the assignment of error also seems overly broad. It doesn't lay its finger on what the error was. It simply alleges that it was error to deny the motion to suppress. So on both of those bases, I believe it would be the court would be within its power to procedurally default the appeal.
Mr. Jones, on the merits, on the issue of the all persons present issue, it seems to me that the real nut of the case is whether the search warrant provides probable cause to believe that the people on the premises would have drugs in their possession. And I can understand how those people that are present at the time the search is being made, how the magistrate might conclude in light of the criminal enterprise that they had drugs in their possession. But I don't understand how the magistrate could predict that any person arriving on the premises after the search warrant is executed would have drugs in it. Help me with what probable cause the magistrate might possibly have in that regard.
Yes, Your Honor, and especially in a situation like this where the target house is there's probable cause to believe that that is the center of a drug distribution operation, then it is not unreasonable to believe that that probable cause to believe that people presently at the house, have evidence of that drug distribution operation also applies to people arriving at the house during the execution of the search.
Well, how long would that probable cause exist? Could the police stay there? I mean, suppose it took them 2 days to execute the search warrant. I mean, suppose it was a large premises and it took them 2 days to go through. Anybody that arrives on that premises within those 2 days is subject to being searched?
Your Honor, it's hard to answer that question, really, because probable cause depends on the facts and circumstances. I think that would at least hinge largely on factual findings about that large premises.
But probable cause is being determined by the magistrate before the search warrant is executed, and what evidence was presented to the magistrate that would allow him to conclude that somebody just rolling in on the premises would have drugs there?
Your Honor, if I could look, just take a second to look at the application that was submitted in support of the
And to take Judge Petty's point a step further, what if the UPS man showed up? Would he be subject to search because he's on the premises? Or does it evolve because in this particular instance, the person who was the target of the search provided information to suggest that other individuals may be involved in the transactions?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that even if we're going at this under the warrant, from the warrant angle, I believe that the probable cause would be there to search anyone that was rolling up. Now, if you had a UPS guy or the mailman, there's an innocent explanation for their presence there, and so there may not be law enforcement may not want to search them. But I believe that with the facts that we have here. With Mooneyham calling Bartley, asking for methamphetamine, and Bartley responding quickly to that the probable cause would extend to him.
This seems to me to be quite similar to an anticipatory search warrant. and we've got a number of cases dealing with anticipatory search warrants where the, you know, the police intercept a shipment of drugs going to a location, and then they pretend to be the UPS guy. They obtain a search warrant to search the house immediately after the drugs are delivered. And the case law on that is that there has to be evidence that the drugs are on a sure course of delivery to the location to be searched. And I don't know why we wouldn't apply that kind, same kind of standard to a search warrant that anticipates somebody, some third party arriving at the scene.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess my response to that would be that this search warrant didn't really anticipate that there would be a third party, and I understand that this is an issue of first impression, whether people arriving at a scene during the execution of a warrant are subject to that warrant, whether they fall within the scope. But, Your Honor, I don't believe the court needs to reach that question. As we outlined in the brief, the search of Bartley's car was supported by the under the automobile exception. The officers had probable cause to believe that the vehicle had contained contraband, and it was readily mobile. So if I know that the court tries to decide cases on the narrowest and best grounds, and that may well prove to be the narrowest and best grounds for this case.
Okay, let me make sure I understand your argument, counsel. What you would suggest to the court is that the warrant allowed them to be on the premises generally. And arguably, the warrant may have been overbroad in that it allowed you to search people who may be on the premises in anticipatory searches, as Judge Petty talked about. But in this instance, it evolved into something else, giving the officers what we would call traditional probable cause to search the vehicle based upon the exigent circumstances and automobile exception to the Fourth Amendment.
I guess, Your Honor, I wouldn't agree with that characterization necessarily. I would say that there, that you could either find that it was acceptable under the automobile exception. The police did have the right to be there because they were executing the warrant. I wouldn't say that necessarily evolved into a situation or that it was where the automobile exception applied. It was kind of a singular fact pattern, I believe, with Mooneyham offering to invite his supplier and bringing him over, and then, you know, once the officers were faced with that that situation, I think it would have been probably malfeasance and bad police work to have turned Mooneyham's offer down at that point.
Let me ask you this, counsel: do you believe your argument is better based on the warrant or better based on the exigent circumstances?
I'm more comfortable with the automobile exception, Your Honor. That's why we led with it in the brief, because I know that the warrant question does contain issues of first impression that aren't settled in Virginia. I cited to what supplemental authority I could, or what.
What about the appellant's argument that there's no showing of the reliability of the person that told the police officer that he would be delivering drugs to the location?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the reliability of Mooneyham was certainly bolstered by Bartley's response to his invitation. So, you know, Mooneyham calls and says, I need more methamphetamine. Bartley shows up. I think there was a range of minutes.
He didn't really say, I need more methamphetamine. He said, I'm ready for another one, or something to that effect, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. And, you know, it's not uncommon for people engaged in the drug trade to use sort of coded language like that, but I think everyone was on the same page and understood that that was what was being requested, was more methamphetamine. With an order of cheeseburgers...
And, Mr. Jones, certainly that appears to have been the fact finder's conclusion, that it was an order of meth. And, in fact, I believe your opponent conceded that earlier.
Yes, Your Honor, that's also accurate, and the fact finder's decision in that was supported by evidence, so I don't believe that it can be reversed at this stage.
Suppose that Moynihan had just provided this information to the police, and the police had then gone to the magistrate to obtain a search warrant for the car. Would that information alone support the credibility, the reliability of that information?
If Mooneyham had told them, merely told them that his supplier was Bartley, and that was all, or if they went through whole sequence of events where he called them.
If they'd just taken this information and gone to the magistrate and just said, Mooneyham, I can't pronounce it, had told us that he called up his supplier and ordered some more methamphetamine and it was on the way, would that information alone support the issuance of a search warrant without any indication of the reliability, the credibility of the source?
Without Bartley having yet arrived, I don't know that it would, Your Honor. But that's why, we also have the additional fact that Bartley did arrive, and that was what provided the probable cause for the warrantless search. It both bolstered Mooneyham's credibility, and it was evidence standing alone of his response that provided that probable cause, Your Honor. So, beyond that, I would just rely on the arguments that are presented in the brief. I'm happy to answer any additional questions that the court has.
Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Mom.
Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Hallahan, you have your rebuttal remaining.
Yes, Your Honors. Thank you. Looking at page 65 of the appendix down at the bottom, it talks about how when the law enforcement, when they got Mooneyham, they had him in custody, they separated him from the other people, and Corporal Zelligan, Sergeant Hilliard interviewed him. He was in custody. He was not free to leave. It's not reliable. It would have been reliable if they had seen him do a meth deal with my guy before or with somebody else, but they hadn't before. They've never dealt with this guy one-on-one before. And then when someone's got the spotlight on trying to weasel the way out of anything, they could offer anything. But he was in custody. He wouldn't have been allowed to make that phone call unless the police let him. He was in custody. People can't just use the phone when they're in custody and call whoever they want. So he was, even though he might have suggested it, he was under the direction and he couldn't do anything without law enforcement permission. And with reference to the reliability, there's nothing that he has done to show himself reliable. And I argue that that's not enough to search the vehicle, even when it arrives.
What if we had this situation where the person who was the focus of the search warrant said to the police as he was being arrested, he said, "Hey, gentlemen, I want to help myself here, and there's a guy who's going to be coming to my place in 45 minutes with a pretty big haul." And would that be enough for the police to go to a magistrate, if they could get to a magistrate in 45 minutes, and say, "We have information from a person that we've just arrested indicating that a person with a large amount of methamphetamine is coming to this premises in the next 45 minutes. Would that be enough to get a search warrant?"
Well, I would argue that it would not be for the same reason, but they wouldn't need the warrant because if they just waited, he would be coming there on his own and they could search him anyway on the valid search warrant they already had.
Isn't that almost what we have here, other than the fact that he called the person? Isn't that almost what we have here?
Well, I would say I wouldn't use the word almost because it's not what we have. The fact that he called that person, it was somebody the police had no knowledge of. It was a completely unknown third party. It could be anybody. And your example was the person was already en route before the police even got there. In this particular case, this guy wouldn't ever come over there unless he was called. I still say the behest of law enforcement allowed them to make the call, allowed Mooneyham to make the call.
Mr. Hallahan?
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure I'm on the same page. You don't dispute that, viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, our situation is Mooneyham calls your client, orders more meth, and within a short period of time after that phone call, your client arrives.
I agree. In the light most favorable, I don't think there's any other explanation for ready for another one is for any legal substance.
Given that as our factual scenario and the additional fact found by the fact finder, your client's arrival. I mean, it seems to me that goes to whether there's probable cause to believe he has meth.
There's a good explanation for it. What if I'm ready for another one? Means come by and pick me up. We're gonna go get some.
Well, right.
And that may have been the case because my guy didn't show up with any. I know you can't look at it after the fact, but there's nothing in the record saying that when he says he's ready for some, he actually brings it with him. He could take the guy to buy it. Maybe Mooney Ham's got the money. My guy's got the connection. He comes, picks up Mooney Ham, or comes and picks up the money. We don't know how it works.
But the case law is pretty clear that just because there is a reasonable, innocent explanation for the activity, that doesn't negate the issue of probable cause. Probable cause is not more likely than not. It's actually quite a bit lower than that.
I understand. I think that the fact that
if
he was lured over there,
if the facts are, as we just discussed, most favorable to the Commonwealth, isn't it reasonable for a police officer in that circumstance to believe that your client would have meth? I mean, isn't that really the issue?
I guess I could answer either way. I could answer yes. It's possible he could have meth. I'm just trying to be straight shooter here. It's possible the guy could have meth.
And it's more than just random possibility. I mean, we have the police officer can reasonably take the facts that we have recited and say it's more likely that that person has meth than somebody just walking down the street, given our circumstances.
I understand your point. I wouldn't argue it, but I understand it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, do you have one more question?
Just the fact that in exigent circumstances, this is not a traffic stop on the side of an interstate. This is a car parked on private property. They could have detained the guy and gotten a warrant. There was no exigent circumstances, or the car wasn't readily mobile because he was being detained.
Your time has expired. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Jones, we appreciate yours as well. And with that, the case is submitted. We will adjourn and reconvene in conference.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your
time. Thank you very much. Bye.